From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
The government's economic decision-making in these extraordinary times is highly dependent on getting accurate and very fast information about what's happening in the business world and in Australia's households. Perhaps at no point in Australia's history has the demand for real-time information been more crucial. Dr. David Gruen is head of the Australian Bureau of Statistics, which is providing many of the numbers. He's here to talk with us today about how the Bureau is responding to the demands being put on it. David Gruen, has the Bureau had to expand its output of data as a result of the pandemic?
I think the answer to that, Michelle, is that as the crisis was building in late February, we had a strong sense that the storm was coming. It hadn't yet arrived, but the storm was coming. And the last time I had a feeling like that was in the second half of 2008, as the financial crisis was building steam in the United States and in Europe. And at that time, it was clear that there was a big shock coming. And I had the same sort of sense that given what was happening with the by late February, the virus had spread out of Wuhan and there were lockdowns beginning to happen in big increases in cases in Italy and in Iran, and I had the sense that this was a coming storm and a sense that we in the Bureau were in a unique position to provide high quality, quick information that that decision makers would find very valuable. So it wasn't a case of having to expand our output. It was more a case of asking ourselves, what more could we do?
Now, you're working on a much more rapid turnaround these days. What sort of timelines do you aim for? What's the turnaround from a survey to publication?
So the discussions we had in late February were all about what more could we do. And we are known for having very high quality surveys with large sample sizes, but they take time to be analysed. And my sense was very much, surely we can provide smaller surveys much more quickly. And already in late February, we were planning planning to see whether we could put in the field surveys for businesses and households that where you would collect the data over the phone a few days, 3 to 5 days, and then you would analyze it over 3 to 5 days and to make it representative, and then you would release the results. So we have been releasing results from these new quick surveys, sometimes from the first day of collection to publication is as little as 10 days.
And before you hadn't done these instant surveys?
That's right. Before this crisis, we hadn't done these surveys, partly because they're not as accurate as bigger, more careful surveys. But in a situation where things are changing fast, and there's enormous uncertainty, my sense was there's huge value in us finding out as carefully as we can how businesses and households are reacting to these changed circumstances. And in fact, to tell a story, the first business survey that we ran started collecting data on the 16th of March. And we had planned to collect from businesses for 2 weeks. But after the first week, the social distancing rules changed so substantially that we decided that we should simply stop the survey after the first week and publish the results, because the second week would have looked completely different from the first. And so we thought there was benefit in simply stopping the survey where it was, which was at about 1,200 businesses, analysing the results and releasing them. So we started that survey on the 16th of March and we published the results on the 26th.
So just in terms of process, you outsource the actual collection of this material, do you? You have a...
No, we collect it ourselves. So we have interviewers and we have an interviewer workforce of about 400 people who do our interviews. And normally, in normal circumstances, some proportion of those interviews are done over the telephone and some proportion are done face-to-face by people actually knocking on doors. But we had to, for safety reasons, we had to suspend face-to-face interviews, and so we were doing it simply over the telephone, and we encourage people in our bigger surveys to fill them in over the web, but for these quick surveys they're simply done over the telephone.
Did you have to put on more staff to do this?
So we didn't. But the reason we didn't was because there were other surveys that we were about to start that we couldn't do because they required face-to-face interaction. And so we had to suspend some of our work program because that was no longer safe. And we redeployed people to do this, to do these fast surveys and to keep up the response rates for the surveys which are of particular importance at this sort of time, like the labour force survey. Just to give you a sense, as I said, these business and household surveys are of the order of 1,000 or 1,200 respondents, and the labour force survey is of the order of 50,000. So that gives you a sense of the different order of magnitude.
So very much quick and dirty, as they say in the trade, but nevertheless you feel accurate enough to be really useful at this time.
Yeah, I guess we at the ABS wouldn't sign up to the word dirty, but I
get, you know what I mean.
I get the meaning, and yes, the answer is in a situation where you really have very little, where there's an enormous uncertainty, you don't have much sense of the extent of things and where they're hitting, other than via anecdotes, being able to survey 1,200 businesses or 1,000 households can give you information which is a lot more accurate than simply talking to your friends and neighbours. So, for instance, for the business survey, we had enough data that we could disaggregate it by industry and get careful information on the proportion of businesses that have been affected by whether they were in hospitality or whether they were in mining, et cetera. So we could analyse all that data within 3 days and publish it.
Now, can you share with us something in terms of the content of what you've found, some of the most interesting findings? For example, do you have any information on children being kept at home, on whether households felt lonely, on how many of them had problems with the internet and things of that sort?
Certainly, Michelle. So just to give it a little bit more context before I answer those questions, because we can collect the data so quickly and then publish it quickly, we can go back into the field every couple of weeks with a new set of questions, and we've been in constant communication with the Treasury Department, the Prime Minister and Cabinet, and Reserve Bank, and they've been suggesting topics to us as these surveys have evolved. So we've now released 4 household surveys and 4 business surveys. So to answer your question, in the latest household survey, which was published on the 29th of May, we found that 3 in 4 parents had kept their children home from school or childcare due to COVID-19. And interestingly, and I guess this doesn't surprise me so much, but it's still a pretty remarkable statistic, women were almost 3 times as likely to have stayed at home to look after their children on their own than men. So 46% of women had, compared to 17% of men. In terms of access to the internet, about 15% of parents said that a lack of access to a stable internet connection was impeding their children's ability to undertake schooling from home. And then in an earlier survey, we asked about the common stressors that people were experiencing from being at home. And the most common was loneliness, with women more with 28% of women reporting feeling lonely compared to 16% of men. So overall, only about a fifth of people said they were lonely, but that was the most common of the personal stressors that they reported.
So you had a couple of things going on here. You had parents finding or having to take more of a burden upon themselves with the children at home. On the other hand, presumably another set of people were feeling more lonely.
Yeah, indeed. Well, people may even feel lonely with their kids at home. That may not be.
How does that work?
Well, I think feeling lonely in the sense of not having the sort of interactions that make them feel whole.
No
that's
escape.
That's a whole other topic. That's a whole other topic, I think, Michelle.
Someone should put a question in about that.
Yeah,
now,
indeed.
Apart from your surveys, you're getting new information, aren't you, on payrolls and jobs, and that's coming in very fast, direct from the Australian Taxation Office. How did collecting that come about?
So that's a nice story. We have been in discussions with the Australian Taxation Office about getting access to these data for many months. Let me just describe what the data is, because it gives a sense of how valuable it is. The Taxation Office has a program called Single Touch Payroll, which is the way in which businesses that are do their payroll electronically can in real time interact with the tax office in terms of the amount of wages they're paying their employees and how much tax they're paying and their superannuation liability. So all of that information goes to the tax office whenever they do their payroll. So they might do their payroll weekly, or they might do it fortnightly, or some might do it monthly. But every time an employing business does its payroll, it sends this information to the tax office. Now, not every employing company in Australia operates through single touch payroll, but a very substantial proportion of them do. So for small businesses with less than 20 employees, about 70% report through single touch payroll. And for businesses with 20 or more employees, 99% of them report through single touch payroll. So these data are a very large share of the employees across the whole economy. So what we do is we're not interested in the identity of these people. So we get de-identified information that enables us to look at changes in payroll jobs over time and the wage bill right across the economy. So we get this data weekly from the tax office, and it requires a certain amount of statistical magic in the background to make sense of these data, because there's an enormous amount of data that gets that is relevant to this, and you have to extract information from that data. But we've done that, and so we have been publishing every fortnight an update of what is happening across the economy to the number of paid payroll jobs and the wage bill across the economy. And we can either look at it for the whole country, we can look at it by state, we can look at it by region, and we can look at it by industry. So it isn't every employee in the country, but it's not too far off that. And so we've been publishing these data, and it gives a very quick. It's not quite real time, but it's within a couple of weeks of being real time. So it's a huge addition to the statistical arsenal that we've been able to provide.
And this is quite new, is it?
It's very new. We were in discussions with the, as I said, we were in discussions with the ATO for many months, and then the arrival of the virus was just a sort of signal that this was now an urgent need, because it would be so valuable in capturing the downturn and then the recovery. And so we said to the tax office that this was now, if it was possible, could we get this kind of as soon as possible? And the tax office was extremely accommodating and got the data to us. I think in the second half of March is when we got the data.
Just speaking of the tax office, as someone whose work life is all about counting and making sure that counts are accurate, were you surprised that the tax office didn't pick up that error earlier in the information it was gathering for JobKeeper applications?
So I have had a look at what happened there, and so firms were asked initially that, I mean, obviously there was a premium on getting JobKeeper out the door as quickly as possible. And so firms were asked to report to the tax office how many employees they thought would be eligible for JobKeeper. Something like 900,000 firms reported to the tax office. And of those 900,000, 0.1% misread the form. So 0.1% is not a very big number, but the ones that, instead of putting, when they were asked how many employees, instead of saying two employees, they wrote a number like 3,000, because they misinterpreted it as how much money they were going to get. So I can very much understand if there's a premium on doing this as quickly as possible, and there's not, and this is simply indicative information, which is not going to lead to that. None of the payments were based on that first piece of information. That was simply information to help them kind of organise themselves. So I can absolutely understand how that happens. You're focused on making sure there isn't fraud and getting the stuff out the door as quickly as you can. And this piece of information turned out to be wrong, and they found that out when there was subsequent interaction with companies who had to actually tell the tax office who the employees were and give details. And then it became clear that some small proportion of firms had simply misread the previous form.
Nevertheless, in what you do, getting information correct must be constantly, of course, on your mind. We're speaking on National Accounts Day. We often see figures in the National Accounts later revised. Is this a real problem, and how do you counter it? How do you maximise the accuracy in the first place, make sure there's not human error, systems error?
It's a good question, Michelle, because and I think a nice way to talk about it is, one of the issues that we had to confront when we were going to run these small surveys was that the information we collected was going to be less accurate than the information that would subsequently be published in the labour force survey. So I mentioned before that our household survey, which does ask some simple questions about employment, the employment circumstances of the households, I mentioned that there's 1,000 people in those surveys compared to 50,000 in the labour force survey. So, of course, the information that comes from the labour force survey is much more precise than the information that comes from these small surveys. And one of the issues that we've had to confront in publishing the estimates from the small surveys is to make the point as clearly as we can that the margin of error on our estimates is much higher in these small surveys. So we go to some trouble every time we publish the results from the small surveys to say that you can see small changes from 1 2-week period to the next, but these undoubtedly they're going to get some attention in the media, but we go to some trouble to say, remember that there's a sizable margin of error around these numbers, and don't overinterpret them. So my feeling was that it was best for us to report the outcomes from these small surveys and be as clear as we possibly could be that the margins of error are significantly bigger than in the subsequent publications. Now, not everybody reads the fine print, but it wasn't in fine print. We made sure the print was the same size as everything else. But I do understand that can be misinterpreted. But my attitude to this is to be as upfront as you possibly can be and explain the situation. You then moved on to revisions in the national accounts, and I guess the way to think about that is, we're publishing the accounts for the March quarter here on the 3rd of June. So there's a fair bit of time has elapsed from the end of the March quarter, and we use that time to do the best job we can to come up with an estimate of economic activity in the March quarter. But if you ask me the question, when would you publish in order that there weren't subsequent revisions, the answer would be in about 5 years' time. So that is not very much use to people. So we are in a world where we have to publish understanding that it will not, that we will get a better estimate with the passage of subsequent time. And actually, looking at how big the revision, we keep track of how big our revisions are. Is there any bias in them? All of those sort of issues are to make sure that the first estimates that we come up with are as good as they can possibly be.
What do you think of the media's handling of statistics? Do you think that they don't look at the fine print, they don't look at margins of error adequately? For example, not an area you're dealing with, but we do see big interpretations come off very small movements in surveys of voting intentions.
Yeah, that's true. And in fact, just for your, since we're talking numbers, I think a lot of the surveys of voting intentions, those surveys are the order of about 2,000 voters. So just to go back to the numbers, that's closer to the small surveys that we're running on households compared to the labour force survey, which is 50,000 and we 50,000 each month. So no question that the margins of error on voting surveys are significant, and I think media outlets differ in the veracity with which they report the extent to which the things have changed. But I guess there's news in any movement, and so there's a kind of incentive that some people find hard to resist to make the most of it, even if it really doesn't mean very much. So I think my answer is, provided organisations that produce statistics are clear about what the margins of error are, we're now in a world where people can go, because everything, you know, most things are now on the net. If people don't like the newspaper write-up of something, they can almost always go to the original source and read it themselves. So it's not perhaps ideal, but I think it's the information is available for people who want to access it.
Now, we're getting, at least in relative terms, fairly near the next census, which will be in August 2021. How are preparations for that going?
So the answer to that is we are ramping up our preparations for the census in 2021. We've got an operational readiness exercise, which is a kind of dry run that we're doing in late October this year. So we are going to try out as much of the processes and technology that we have developed, and we're going to try that out in a run which will be a as I say, a dry run for, and it will be, and it will operate in a whole lot of different neighbourhoods. So some remote neighbourhoods, some inner city neighbourhoods, where we're getting a mix of neighbourhoods that we're doing this dry run for the census on. And the reason for doing that is to make as sure as possible that we've ironed out all the glitches before we get anywhere near August 2021.
So people will actually fill in forms in those neighbourhoods?
Yes, yes, that's right. And so, we try and make it as realistic as we can, but obviously it's not the real thing.
Now, last time we saw a horrific computer system collapse. Are you confident that that's all going to be okay?
So what I'm confident of is that everyone involved is well aware of the experience of 2016, and an enormous amount has been done to make sure we don't have a repeat of that experience. So we have... So there is an awful lot of work being done to make sure that nothing like that happens again. I'm not going to make a statement which says that nothing bad can ever happen. But we are taking we are working as hard as possible to make sure that that we don't have a repeat of that.
Will there be new questions this time?
So there are two new topics that we are going to be asking questions on. One is to do with chronic health conditions, and the other is to do with veterans, whether people have served in the military. And we're also taking a question off, which is there has been, over the last few censuses, a question on internet use, and we think that that no longer deserves a place, because we've got alternative ways of looking at that information, and for most people they have internet. There are interesting processes around the census. So the topics that are being that we're going to be asking questions on a former disallowable instrument in the Parliament. So we have to allow 15 sitting days for both the House of Representatives and the Senate for anyone to potentially disallow the topics. We've got to the stage now, we're close to the end of that disallowance period, and provided no one has any objections, then the topics are decided.
Do you think people are becoming less or more willing to give information to the census?
So there is a worldwide trend to that response rates, both for surveys and for censuses, are coming down a bit. So everyone is having more difficulty getting their communities to fill this in. I guess the way I see it is it's a bit like voting, in the sense that that voting obviously has voting is something that imposes a small cost on individuals, but it's a kind of bedrock of our system. And likewise, filling in the census takes 20 or 30 minutes and imposes some costs on people, but there's huge public value in having an accurate sense, having an accurate census, because you collect an enormous amount of information which is of value both to government decision makers but also to decision makers in the community. So learning the things that you learn from the census forms the basis for an awful lot of decision making in subsequent years. So I think it is, there are commonalities with voting, in the sense that what we're asking people to do is spend a small amount of time doing something for the wider public good.
And it is, of course, compulsory.
Yes, both are.
But are people concerned about the privacy aspects, and what about being tracked over time, or can they just not be bothered doing it?
I'm not sure of what the I think I think it may be that some proportion of people simply kind of don't, you know, don't take their civic responsibility seriously. I think, and I think that's unfortunate, and it perhaps is a kind of a small example of the wider kind of loss of trust in institutions. On retention of information, quite a lot of commentary in the lead up to the last census about retention of information, and some disquiet. And so we have decided that this time what we're going to do is a full year before the census, we are going to release information about exactly what we're going to do. We have we've got what's called a privacy impact assessment being done by an independent agency to look an independent group to look at privacy aspects of the census, and they have given us a report about what they recommend, and we're looking at that report, and we will be releasing the privacy impact assessment and our reaction to it a full year out from the census, so that we're not having these discussions in the weeks leading up to the census.
David Gruen, the Bureau is obviously at a particularly interesting point in the collection of information and the expansion of the data that you're providing to government and especially, importantly, to the public. We thank you very much for sharing your insights with us today. That's all for this podcast from The Conversation. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassie. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.